Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And my name is Mike Gibb. I run AccountsRecovery.net, and it is my extreme pleasure to be here today bringing you this webinar entitled Email is Hot, Texting is Hotter, Don't Be the First to Get Burned. Navigating the technical, legal, compliance, and operational requirements of digital communications is challenging. Understanding use cases for email and text is the first step. Understanding the compliance rules comes next. It is also important to understand the legal guardrails in place today, as well as what we expect from the proposed new rules for debt collection. This webinar is being generously sponsored by Ontario Systems. You'll get the chance to hear about them a little later in our program. I want to take a quick minute and say a few words about AccountsRecovery.net. AccountsRecovery.net is a news and information platform for the ARM industry. The site publishes unique and curated content, maintains a number of email newsletters, hosts webinars like this one, and offers a number of exciting podcasts for the ARM industry. The site is free for anyone in the industry to use and is a great resource of news and insights to help educate and inform. I hope everyone will spend a few minutes every day checking out what it has to offer. Now, let me tell you a little bit about today's speakers. Roseanne Anderson is the Chief Compliance Officer for Ontario Systems. She is responsible for driving the company's consumer financial law compliance program, designing innovative compliance solutions for Ontario Systems products, and leading the company's compliance consulting services and compliance outsourcing programs. Her two decades of experience in the ARM industry make her one of the most respected experts in the industry. David Kaminsky is the chair of the Consumer Financial Services Law Practice at Carlson & Messer in Los Angeles. He represents creditors, banks, debt collectors, and asset buyers in the defense of claims brought under all federal and state consumer protection statutes. He manages the nationwide litigation for numerous financial institutions and has helped shape the law affecting the rights of collection agencies and creditors throughout the United States. He also provides compliance and training advice and successfully defends clients against federal and state regulatory actions. David was a 2019 ACA Foundation Award recipient, the 2016 Attorney of the Year, and the 2013 and 2015 Chair of the Attorney's Division for ACA International. The format for today's webinar will be a presentation from David and Roseanne. We encourage everybody to submit questions, and we will get to them when the presentation has concluded. To submit a question, please enter it into the question tab on your Zoom webinar control panel. This event is being recorded, and a recording will be made available in the coming days on accountsrecovery.net. Finally, I wanted to ask everyone to reserve a minute and fill out the survey that should pop up on your screen after the webinar is over today. You'll also receive a link via email tomorrow to access the survey. Your participation helps make sure the content we're delivering in these webinars is what you're looking for, like the topic we have today. And the speakers you want to hear from definitely can say that about the ones we have with us today. Before I bring David and Roseanne to begin their presentation, I wanted to remind everyone that this webinar is being brought to you by Ontario Systems, which has helped ARM organizations grow and prosper since 1980. Whether you need improved contact management, texting, and integrated payment processing, better reporting on agent productivity, or a compliance audit, Ontario Systems can help. Visit www.ontario.ca to learn more. David, you there?
Yep. Well, thank you so much, Mike. Thank you, Mike Gibbon, Accounts Recovery, and thank you so much, Roseanne Anderson and Ontario Systems, for allowing me to be a part of this webinar. Truly grateful. We have so much to cover with you. I mean, all about text, all about emails, how to launch your email program, and everything that you need to be thinking about when considering your text platform and your email platform. We're not going to be able to do it all today, but we think we're going to make a deep dive into this. We also want your questions, and with Mike's permission, Roseanne and I would be grateful to, of course, do an updated seminar as the law evolves and the rules change and we get some more clarity about what we can do and what we can't do. So with that, let's launch right in today. You know, we have our legal disclaimer that although this sounds like we're giving you legal advice, we are technically not your attorneys. But that if you should need any advice at any time, please don't hesitate to contact us. Glad to help all of you. Roseanne and I have been open books, and we constantly are giving back to the ARM industry. So let's go right on to page 5. Let's talk about what we're going to cover. Of course, this is all about text and emails, but there is a lot of confusion that surrounds all of this, and we're going to get to that. We're going to talk about technology. What are the technology opportunities that are now available for you? Because the world is changing. Letters are going out the door. Everyone says that they're spending a fortune on letters and getting nowhere. What are the laws and regulations that are going to pertain to the type of digital communication program that you may seek to launch, whether that's going to be text, whether that's going to be email, whether it's going to be both, right? What about the new debt collection rules? We're going to try to touch on that at the end, though. You know, we don't know exactly when those are going to come out. We're suspecting around June of possibly 2021, but that remains to be seen, of course. We want to talk about also eSign. eSign has been an enigma for so many of you. Everyone has come up to me and said, what is this eSign? I don't really understand it. People throw it around like a frisbee. Roseanne and I are going to really lay out what it is, what it means, what you need to be concerned about with it, and what you don't. So, and how to launch your program. That's what this is all about. Next. There are so many misconceptions about text and email that are surrounding the industry right now, and there's a lot of confusion. Again, Roseanne and I are going to try to lay it out as clearly as possible so that you can all understand what they are and what are the rules that pertain there too. Text messages, for instance, people are talking about, oh, well, a text message is a writing, so that triggers all these state writing requirements. Well, no, technically a text message really is a call, and therefore, if it's a call in connection with a debt, then one would need to be thinking about all of the rules that pertain to calls and debt collection rules, whether those be the FDCPA and or FDCPA and state laws, depending upon the state in which you are collecting and seeking to send someone a text message. Keyword programs, and then contacting consumers, right? Are they subject to allowable call time restrictions? Yes. People think that, oh, if I'm sending an email, I'm not really bothering anybody. They can get an email at any time, but that's not necessarily true. So we're going to talk about compliance with call time restrictions, just like the FDCPA and state laws currently subscribe. What about this whole issue about pass-through consent from the original creditor? Is that just risk 3? So many of you know that under the TCPA, the FCC had said if the debt collector is collecting on behalf of the creditor and the creditor has consent, then that consent passes through to the debt collector. But is it risk-free? Absolutely not. So if you're sending a text message, for instance, that could be deemed a call. If you don't have consent to make that text message, just like a call under the TCPA, you have potential liability. So some things to be concerned about. What we knew in the past pertaining to text and to calls under the TCPA pertains today. What about this whole human intervention requirement, right? Is that the only requirement you need to launch a call? Absolutely not. We're going to get into the details. What about frequency of calls? Do text messages count against your frequency? Well, if a text message is considered a call, then you have to be thinking about frequency and state harassment laws and FDCPA harassment laws. Ringless voicemail, are they not subject to the TCPA? Well, you know that there's a big, big fight in the Saunders. We're going to actually leave that for another day because it's just too big of a topic to get in today. And then eSign, again, does it pertain to the ARM industry? Roseanne and I believe that it does. Does it apply to only certain aspects of it? Yes, we're going to explain when and where, and we're going to demystify this whole eSign issue. So with that, I turn it over to Roseanne to go to slide 7.
All right. So we just thank you, David, and thank you, Mike. Again, appreciate being a part of this afternoon's webinar. When we talk about email or electronic communications, we are, for practical purposes for the debt collection industry today, talking about email or text messaging or chats. So just to make sure that we are aligned in our conversation, the email is the written communication. It is in a digital version of a written communication. So just keep that in mind. So when we talk a moment ago, when we talked about the myths, et cetera, an email would only trigger, or I should say, will trigger restrictions, as would any type of writing. While if we move on to a text is a call to a mobile number. And we're going to get into a little bit more detail about a creative argument a plaintiff's attorney brought and lost. Finally, a chat is a communication exchange with a consumer using a similar technology to text. And one thing that people always ask about when it comes to chats is, don't we immediately, if a text is a call and a chat is a text, don't we immediately exceed all sorts of state and or federal call frequency restrictions? And I'll just say it now, and we may touch on it later, we'll depend on the time. If you are engaging in chat communications, my one piece of, it's not legal advice, and we may as well reiterate that again. We are both lawyers, but we're not providing legal advice. You need to consult with independent legal counsel. But a chat is best positioned in the third-party debt collection industry as a conversation that has a start and a stop. So if you are chatting with consumers, I would strongly recommend that you consider introducing the chat, clearly letting the consumer know that we are now going to begin this conversation, provide any required disclosures at the state or federal level pertaining to calls, and then close that communication and make it very clear the consumer may obtain a transcript. Next slide, please. The laws and regulations, we always like to, lawyers, it's very difficult for us to present a webinar without at least laying out the framework of kind of where does the madness start. And it usually comes from the laws and regulations, and certainly from judicial decisions. When it comes to digital communications, electronic communications, we're looking at the FDCPA, the TCPA, the Electronic Signatures and Global National Commerce Act at a minimum. If you're processing payments using any sort of digital form of communication, obviously the Electronic Funds Transfer Act may impact your workflow. Regulatory enforcement of these laws and regulations would be accomplished through the CFPB. The proposed rules for debt collection are heavy with provisions addressing when, how, and what you can text and email a consumer. Those rules are not in effect, so therefore, our comments today, unless we tell you clearly we're speaking of proposed rules, we are talking about the law as it exists today. With all of its murkiness, with all of its clarity, however you want to view it, it's today, how do you function in today's world using text and email, as opposed to how will we function in the future using the proposed rules once finalized. The Federal Trade Commission has a role in the enforcement of the laws mentioned above, in particular the FDCPA. The Federal Communications Commission does with regard to the TCPA, and a body that many people are slowly becoming familiar with, the Cellular Telephone and Internet Association, oftentimes referred to as the Wireless Association, is a self-regulatory body. No, there is not a private right of action. You're not going to be sued for violating a CTIA requirement, but I think it's helpful to compare it to NACHA. A lot of you recognize or do use the Automated Clearinghouse Network, and the National Automated Clearinghouse Network Association, or NACHA, is the self-regulatory body over how that network functions and how you can use it. So too with the CTIA. That's probably the best example I can give you. So you're not going to be sued under NACHA, but you might have some serious contractual issues. Next slide, please. When we talk about the various business models, I've been in conversations before where I the reason I've sorted these business models in the way that is presented here to you is because it's like you know, that slime kids have that just, that's how some conversations are about text messaging. It slips through your fingers. So if I'd like to make it more rigid by saying, if we're talking about creditors or extended business office companies, when it comes to texting, they're worried about the TCPA and the CTIA. Not the FDCPA, okay? And healthcare providers, they're worried about what, as appears, TCPA, HIPAA, and the CTIA. The first party collector, or the early out agency, if you will, again, is going to be TCPA and CTIA, but they're not going to be adhering to the FDCPA because they're acting as the image and likeness of the, it's kind of a religious reference, but it's a image and likeness of the creditor. And then, of course, the third party, we introduce the FDCPA. Various state laws can blur some of these lines because some state laws with regard to debt collection do impact a creditor, including a healthcare provider. But I think this helps us sort through the various business models and how the regulations impact them. Next slide. David, are we turning this to you at this point?
Yep. Thank you, Roseanne. So let's talk about types of consent, right? And substituting our electronic delivery for your snail mail. So getting informal consent to text or email, right? You have consent to text. You have consent to email. You can use that for basic collection. Someone has asked, and they always ask this question, do we need consent under the law to email someone? Technically, you do not. However, if you're going to email someone, you want to make sure at least that you have an email address that someone has provided to you. That way you have some assurances, of course, that the person that provided you that gave you permission to do so, it is their email address and that you have consent to send them information to us, which also gives you, it minimizes, of course, the risk of third-party disclosures. We're going to get into that in more detail. But if you're getting consent to text someone, you still have to remember, okay, this is in the context of I'm texting someone now in connection with a payment obligation in connection with debt collection. I don't have to comply with TCPA, do I? No, in fact, you absolutely do. And in fact, there was some misunderstanding with regard to the CFPB's notice of proposed rulemaking. People thought, oh, all of a sudden the CFPB is suggesting that we can text under certain circumstances. Are they doing away with the consent requirement? And the answer to that so far is absolutely not. The CFPB does not have purview over the TCPA, only over the FDCPA. So consent still has to apply with the TCPA requirements, FCC orders. Remember, when you're texting, a text is a call. So the same rules that pertain to a call using those autodialers still apply. A text is not a pre-recorded message. Again, CTIA, that's the body that is governing for short codes, and you do need to comply with CTIA for various reasons we're going to get into in more detail later. It is terrific guidance, and it's actually help you going to inform you and help you with your text message platform should you choose to use one. Look, when you're getting consent for texting or your email, it's all about your documentation. When you get the consent to text documented in your compliance management system, train your agents how to obtain that consent and to document it. And of course, if you're getting that text consent orally and not on a web form, then you also want to make sure that you are recording, because that recording gives you your evidence that you can present in a court of law to demonstrate this person gave his consent to email, to text, over the phone, and they did so orally, and we've got the evidence to back it up. And I wanted to say, and I should have said at the very outset, forgive me, all of you, for my voice. I am suffering from some bad bronchitis, and but we're going to push through this, and hopefully I won't lose my voice during the middle of this.
David, you sound so great. Very commanding. I'd like to make a couple of comments on this slide. And by the way, sure. When we go back and forth, audience, we are anticipating this. So it's, I always like to let people know we're not just being rude to one another. Anyway, the reason this slide has informal and formal consent is not because you could ever Google search and find a legal reference to that. That is something we're using to drive home the fact that informal consent, they're both valid, they're both very important, but it's to drive home the fact that consent to text or consent to email is what you need to think about when you're using it for basic collection type. If we were in a live audience, I'd probably ask you, what on earth do you think I mean by basic collection communications? But I won't, and so I'll answer it myself. And the basic collection communications would be, here's a receipt, here's a confirmation that it's paid in full, your next payment date is Friday, your balance is $200, yes, you have a payment plan. Everything I just said, there's nothing legally required about it, right? You can't go to the FDCPA and find a provision that says, please provide a written receipt to a consumer. It doesn't exist. But it is part of basic collection, let's say, functionality and workflow. But formal consent is a way to highlight or shed light on the fact that if you are interested in substituting the digital delivery of a certain kind of document, the digital delivery of it, as opposed to using the U.S. mail or certified mail, then you need a special kind of consent called e-sign consent, and we will talk about that later. But they are dramatically different, and they serve different purposes. How you get them, whether it's by, you can actually obtain formal e-sign consent using a text message. You can obtain formal e-sign consent over the phone. There are going to be some other requirements in terms of demonstrating the person's ability to use the particular text mobile number or the particular email address. But nonetheless, just please understand that when it comes to substituting the digital delivery, think saving money on postage and paper, if you're doing that to send a legally required notice, a notice that must be provided in writings, like a validation notice that wasn't provided in the initial communication, then you need e-sign consent. Back to you, David.
Actually, if I could just interrupt briefly, there was a question that came in based on the conversation and the point that you and David were both making, and I wanted to ask it before we moved on. Mm-hmm. What if a client provides you with an email address and we did not receive it directly? Would it still be okay to email the consumer? Do either one of you want to tackle that one?
David, I have no, I actually don't know how David would answer this, but I know how I will answer it. I would say that it passes. If you're the third-party debt collector, or certainly the first party, the email consent would pass, and there we are not operating under any framework yet of work email versus personal email address. The key is that here's the practical problem. The practical problem is, how reliable is that email address? Forget about the proposed rules for a second. How reliable is it? Because if you use the email and you accidentally, if you use the email and it was somehow routed to another Roseanne Anderson, for example, you arguably have triggered an unlawful disclosure of the debt to a third party without the original consenting person's email address. Number one, it's probably a one-off lawsuit. Not that that's not important. Number two, email addresses are rarely reassigned, very low risk. Number three, I do think that the assignment would work. Number four, I think that your first salvo to the person would be inviting them to confirm the email address and explaining that this is a communication from a debt collector, but I probably wouldn't dump all sorts of documentation into the initial email. Finally, Canned Spam will tell you that you shall include an unsubscribe option in the bottom of every email so that the person can always unsubscribe. And so I guess my answer is yes with that understanding. David?
Yes. Roseanne, I echo all of that. And this goes back to something that we've talked about so many times. It's all about what is the quality of the documentation that you have obtained and what is the source of that information. If you're getting cell phone numbers, for example, directly from your client and you have the evidence to back it up, that's a pretty good indication of where that cell phone came from. If your client says, we don't skip trace, we only get them directly from the source, from the consumer. Same thing with email. If you're getting an email directly from a particular company that's transmitting it to you and they haven't, quote, scrubbed for email addresses and they don't do it, and there are actually some platforms that you can scrub for email addresses, and people are trying to think, well, can't we use those to obtain email addresses? Could be very dangerous because you never know the source. So the whole key is, what is the source of the email address, of the telephone number that you got in the beginning? And that's how you assess if you're going to use it and what is the risk level when you decide that you are going to use it. So moving on to, I hope we answered your question. Moving on to slide 11, just to talk about email communications, giving you an overview. Again, email communications, they are, in fact, written communications. So when you're thinking about your email protocol and your platform, you have to think, okay, well, what are all the federal and the state laws that I have to comply with in thinking about replacing my U.S. mail type of communication now with email? If you're with email, you have to comply with the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act if you are sending, in fact, a communication as defined by the FDCPA. Same thing with state laws. What do state laws say about the particular email communication that you're sending? If the email communication is a substitute for your written letter, then you must comply with the state laws that pertain to sending letters. Then when you're thinking about, again, consent, email communications, we've just sort of already discussed this in detail. Just make sure that you are doing them, that you have permission to send them, and that you have permission to communicate with the consumer at issue. Remember that when you have an email communication and it has a legally required disclosure, you have to then obtain formal consent with eSign. We're going to get into eSign later and very clearly explain what it is and how it works. Then there's this whole issue about personal versus work email, and this is a big debate. If someone provides you with their email address and confirms, let's say, in writing, let's say they got this, they're giving it to you on a web form that gives you terms and conditions of obtaining your email address, your telephone number, et cetera. And if someone voluntarily provides you with the work email address, and if those terms and conditions say you confirm that the email address that you provide to us is a secure and private email address, well, then you potentially can use a work email address. Generally, Roseanne and I think, believe if you can stay away from work email addresses, it's just best to do so. Because, again, you never know who can see it. Does the employer have access to the work email? Can they have access 24/7 to look at any time at someone's private and confidential email that is being sent over to a work email? It's always best to get a personal, non-work email.
But I can't agree with you more, David. I not that this is how the proposed rules will work, but at least as written. But for the law as it stands today, I think, UDAP purposes, it passes the smell test. If you advise a consumer, like you said, please, work email may not be secure. Please use, when choosing an email to communicate with us, please choose one that is private and accessible and under your control, that kind of thing. It's an informed consent then to me. Is there can I give you chapter and verse from a law? No. But does it make sense? I think so, because we are always concerned about, let's say if you sent a collection notice to me at Ontario Systems and then someone reads it and then they think, what do you mean you're getting all these collection notices at work? What's wrong with you? I mean, if it had some sort of caused me harm later on, that's what you don't want to trigger. But anyway, just wanted to underscore that.
Great. And Roseanne, with that, I'd like to ask you a question because it goes right into our next slide. Are emails text messages?
No. emails are not texts, and texts are not emails. Emails are writings, texts are calls. And it was nice to come across a case that documented and supported a 2014 decision. But anyway, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act does not regulate email messages. It regulates phone calls and faxes. In this case, before us, McCarroll versus offers.com, the plaintiff said that he received the emails on his smartphone and he read them, and therefore they were text messages, and therefore they were subject to the TCPA and blah, 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 blah. And the court said, no. The mere fact that emails are sent to an email address and are read on a smartphone does not bring them within the TCPA. And it cites Prukala versus Al, holding that emails received on the same device plaintiff used as a phone did not suddenly bring those communications under the TCPA. So as far as I'm
concerned,
I would print this and put it under your pillow. What? Yes.
And Roseanne is laughing in part right now because this case is absolutely ridiculous. This is, of course, a case where the plaintiff's attorney is desperate to, quote, create new kind of law or a case in some other area, and to try to claim that an email is a text message when the TCPA clearly spells out what falls under the TCPA and has never wavered therefrom is ridiculous. But we have to resolve this issue and clarify it. So that's why it's here. Rosie, what about some basic email considerations that we must think about when we're sending an email?
As it is right now, we want to use, obviously, the name of the consumer will go into the to box. As far as I'm concerned, the name of the consumer is the name of the consumer. The email address, like David said, you shouldn't be buying email address, as far as I'm concerned, to use to communicate with your consuming public. And make sure that you use your true name in the from box. Now you're going to say, but my name says ABC Debt Collector. Isn't that an issue? Well, first of all, to date, that hasn't yet been claimed a basis for an unauthorized third-party disclosure, even when the email address is being shared, let's say, by a couple of individuals. But it does create a risk. And so therefore, my recommendation is that you work with your counsel, examine your name, find out if you need a DBA, and if you do need a DBA for the purposes of texting to not reveal that you are a debt collector in the from line, consult with legal counsel further to determine what bonds that will impact, what states that impacts, any other licensing requirements. In the subject line, I suggest keep it simple. That it's about a payment. In the new rules, they're going to actually want you to indicate that it's the name of a creditor and indicate a number, some other data point in the subject line to help the consumer recognize the purpose of the communication in the email other than just the account number. But under today's law, we really do not have any restrictions in the subject line except that common sense may prevail and our experience with the FDCPA. Excuse me, that you would never want to use it to say you're super bad debt, you're late again, inflammatory statements. Keep it straightforward, keep it simple, keep it businesslike.
Roseanne, just another issue on that when we're talking about the subject line. I've seen, various companies talk about the subject lines and what they're going to put there. And some companies were seeking to put very generic subject lines. You need to at least consider having some kind of spam analytics to determine if the type of subject line you're going to use is going to be a trigger for spam so that your email gets caught up and then never gets read by the consumer, never gets seen by them, but is caught up in spam filters because it's an auto trigger for spam. So there are multiple programs out there that can assist you with that, but it's something you must think about when you're doing your subject line. Then again, keeping it simple is always best.
That's a great comment, David. And what that made me think of is also you know, it's sad to say, but the moment we become clever is the moment we create risk. So in the subject line, you would never want to avoid spam triggers by misspelling words so that we are tricking the spam filters, because in the world of the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, any sort of intentional act on that part, in that respect, would arguably be a UDEP problem or a deceptive practice under the FDCPA. So a misspelled word here and there, unintentional, is one thing. Misspelled words to avoid spam filters is quite another. Here's our favorite. David and I could talk about this for 2 hours. Anyway, you go ahead, Dave.
So, yeah. So let's talk about our favorite case in the world. We call it Lavallee. Some people call it Lavallee. Anyway, Lavallee, very, very interesting case. And now the Seventh Circuit has come out with a decision. So that Seventh Circuit decision is binding upon those states that are Illinois, Wisconsin, and Indiana. So that is the law of the land for those states. And basically what happened here is MedOne sent an email to the plaintiff, and it required the plaintiff, it was supposed to be a 1692G notice, but in order for plaintiff to get that validation notice, they had to go through all of the secure protocol, get all this information, put in passwords, last four digits of Social Security, then they could get the access to click on the hyperlink to try to get access to the 1692G notice. When all was said and done, and we're going to forget about a minute for what the district court said, Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal did agree with the district court in saying that that is not a validation notice. You do not have a particular consumer does not have to click on 50 different things and then click on hyperlinks in order to get a validation notice. And nothing in the particular email said anything about a particular debt. So the Seventh Circuit said, well, not only was this not a proper 1692 validation notice, because number one, you put this person through hoops, and that's not what a validation notice is supposed to do. You're supposed to send someone something in writing that provides them with their validation notice. And the court said, since you didn't talk about a debt, the one thing we're going to say good about this matter is that this was not a, quote, FDCPA communication about a debt, therefore triggering the FDCPA requirements. This is a very good decision on that issue, because the email was very generic. The problem with the email was that you had to go through all these hoops and click on a hyperlink to get to the FDCPA 1692G notice, your first collection notice. Court said, sorry, that doesn't cut it. That's not the way it's done. So, and in fact, in this particular case, to the best of my knowledge, and Roseanne could correct me, that the plaintiff never did in fact click on that hyperlink because she was afraid to, and therefore never did get access to the 1692G notice, so therefore never read it in addition. So first of all, there were so many problems. Number one, if you're going to send an email, and you're going to send an email which is your 1692G notice, then you just need to set forth your entire G notice and your entire, what would be your first letter collection notice, in your email. It's the same thing. You need to treat the email as if it's a letter. You need to treat the rules under the FDCPA as the same with respect to email. So that's very important. Also, the question was, in this case, there was a whole issue about this whole e-sign. Did the plaintiff have to first agree to and provide e-sign compliance before that email could have been ever sent to the plaintiff? Well, the CFPB actually in that case said, yes, in their view, according to our amicus brief, we say that e-sign compliance should have been made in this case, and it wasn't done. Interesting thing is the Seventh Circuit never addressed this whole issue about e-sign compliance in connection with a first debt collection letter. But Roseanne and I are going to talk about that. But again, the Seventh Circuit decision, and I know Roseanne wants to weigh in on some issues here, this is the law of the land in the three states that I mentioned. So to the extent that you're trying to send a first communication via email with a hyperlink, absolutely don't do it. In fact, I wouldn't do it in any part of the country because I don't think it's going to satisfy the requirements, and you're just going to buy yourself a lawsuit. Roseanne?
Yikes. I know I read this a little bit differently, but here's why. As David went through the facts matter. In a lot of cases, the final decision, of course, is important, but the facts that the decision connects to are super important. As David explained, this person did, you know, MedOne, the collection agency, did send these, it was assigned two accounts to collect, and it sent these two very empty emails to the consumer. Each included hyperlinks to the validation notice. David just said, the question really was, did they actually send the validation notice? Because we do have to send the validation notice if it's not provided in the initial communication with the consumer. That's a really important, we don't want to confuse our listeners at all. Few people do it, but if you provide a consumer with your validation notice in your initial communication, there is no writing requirement for that. You could do it verbally. You could use it anyway. But let's say we're talking about a situation where we are attempting to send that validation notice. We know, and we'll see in a slide later on, that that notice has to be in writing. Now, what did we talk about earlier about substituting the electronic delivery of something that you would otherwise have to provide in writing? It triggers e-sign consent. Now, the court in this case could have examined that, but it didn't. So this case actually is completely worthless when it comes to e-sign, because the court, when it went up on appeal to the Seventh Circuit, they pretty much punted on e-sign. And what they said was, David explained this, those first two kind of empty emails, all they had was a link to the validation notice letter. The court said, those really weren't communications in connection with the collection of a debt. I personally am floored by that. What do you think those were, court? Birthday messages? Of course they were, in my opinion, communicate. That's why the guy sent them. You know, MedOne sent them. And the link was simply a way to deliver the validation notice. But as David explained, there were all these hoops the consumer had to face to get to the notice. They never opened it. So how could anybody argue in good faith that they sent something that they know darn well was never seen, clicked, opened? We don't have to prove they read it, but they know darn well in a digital communication environment when something's not even opened. Well, that's kind of the mail delivery of knowing that your mailman in his truck went down in a sinkhole in front of your house and he never delivered the mail. I mean, it's kind of the functional equivalent, but we don't have to worry about that in the U.S. Postal Service. So I guess my comment here would be, let's not forget about e-sign just because the court in its analysis did not address it at the Seventh Circuit level. Remember that the duty to provide a written notice to send it happens not with the initial communication, but if you didn't provide the validation in the initial, then you have a writing requirement. And I would say that my last comment here is that a multi-step process to obtain, I know what they were thinking. They were trying to be prudent and secure about the information, but what they ended up doing was making it kind of a virtual scavenger hunt, and the person never even got to it. So that's really where, you know, just a few of my comments on this case. David?
So apologies for that. Roseanne, I agree with that and thank you. And what the question is going to be always is, and we're not going to have enough time to get there at the end, so we should discuss it right now. When you're thinking about, of course, your email protocols, and if you want to send a first collection letter via email, you need to be thinking of whether or not I do or do not have to get e-sign consent to send a first validation notice if my first validation notice is not my first communication with a consumer. So So Rosanna, I'm going to give you an example.
I would think you do.
And let,
it's not the first communication. Yeah. Hands down.
Okay.
Hands down.
Got it.
It's not the first communication, because you'll see in a later slide, if it is your initial communication and you provide the validation notice during that initial communication, then you don't have the writing. But if your first communication is like a call, a text, something else, hello, how are you doing? Then within 5 days of that initial communication, you shall send the validation notice, and that's where the writing and the e-sign kicks in.
Right. So, in other words, so Roseanne, let's just go over this again for the audience so that they're clear. If we've already spoken to someone on the phone and we've had a discussion with them and that was a communication about a debt, mm-hmm. then you agree that if we are then sending an email thereafter, correct?
Mm-hmm.
That we need to get e-sign consent.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Correct? Great. But if your first...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, if you're going to send it in an email, yeah, you would.
Right. If you're going to send as your first communication a 1692 G notice and you seek to do it via email, mm-hmm. though Roseanne and I believe that e-sign consent is not required for that first 1692 G notice sent via email.
Agreed. 100%.
Agreed. 100%. And I know this has caused a lot of confusion. It's this whole e-sign, and it's also not just e-sign, but it's the interpretation of e-sign with respect to the FDCPA and the FDCPA's 1692 mm-hmm. G language, mm-hmm. which is so important here, because 1692 says within 5 days after that initial communication with the consumer, a debt collector shall, unless the information is contained in the initial communication, send it in writing. Well, if you're not doing an initial communication via the phone and then following up 5 days later or within 5 days with your written communication, your G notice, but you're sending your G notice as the first communication period, then you do not need to comply with the eSign Act.
Right.
So you have to be very, very careful about this and very thoughtful about this when you're setting your email protocols. Because the one thing you don't want to do, you want to make things easy for yourself. You don't want to trigger the e-sign requirements, because e-sign just adds one more layer of consent that you have to do before you send an electronic communication that's mandated. So in order to avoid that, we say that if you're going to send a first communication to a consumer and you want to get your G notice out there and you want to do it by email, that is the first communication that should be sent to the consumer. Therefore, you bypass e-sign.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So with that, Roseanne, I think we switch to slide 17 and we just talk about some important issues with regard to text.
Okay. One more slide, Mike. All right, so when it comes to texting, you'll hear people throwing around words like, well, do you have a short code program or a long code program, or who's writing your keywords for you, blah, blah, blah. And when it comes to text terms, short code means little bitty phone number. It means it's a 5 or 6 digit phone number that the consumers text to. So if somebody asks you for your short code, you give them numbers. Of course, they could spell a word by accident, but the idea is that they are numbers. Keywords is the term that talks to your short code program. So a keyword might be a special word like consent, collect, pizza in the advertising world, and Domino's. A keyword is a unique term comprised of letters, could have some numbers, that consumers use to self-service, to get information automatically and to communicate in our world with the debt collector or the creditor. And perhaps they're going to even make payments using a short code. So this is just an important, just a terminology thing. Understand the difference, because it helps you understand what your program is going to do. The TCPA prohibits certain calls to wireless numbers unless the caller has the prior express consent of the called party. And David explained that the FCC has clearly interpreted calls to include SMS messages, text messages. And it's only when you get into marketing and solicitation text that you're into the prior written consent. So we're not in that world. Unless for some reason you're going to be clever. I just read a case about a bank that used it for, they were texting their consumer, collecting the outstanding balance, but also pushing a new product, a new type of loan. They got their hands slapped pretty quickly and hard because they converted their otherwise non-marketing solicitation text into one, and then they needed prior written consent. Next slide. Companies can certainly obtain verbal consent for non-telemarketing. You guys are all in non-telemarketing. So verbal consent will work. The reason we like the recorded message is because it's evidence of your documentation of that consent, as opposed to a he said, she said. And text calls to wireless numbers made using an automatic telephone dialing system, you obviously need consent to text. There's one step, and you can also have two steps. The one step method is one we alluded to, where the creditor, you believe you have confidence that the mobile number provided to you and associated with the transaction or the debt was conveyed to the creditor by the consumer, and now that mobile number is transferred to you. A lot of you believe that and rely on that for purposes of your auto-dialing consent using your predictive dialers, your ATDSs, I should say, if in fact they can prove you have one. But so too can you transfer the consent to text in the same manner. But the big challenge here, the one thing I just want to mention, is that this doesn't undermine the validity of the consent, but if the mobile number, since the time that I gave my consent to the hospital to text me, and now you have my debt and you're collecting from me, if I've now exchanged or turned in my phone, it's called deactivating my phone and my number. If I did that and that number is reassigned, you have to realize then the consent is no longer good because it's no longer, it's the number is associated with a new person. Next slide.
But Roseanne, likely people won't know and companies won't know technically if a number's been reassigned until hopefully the reassigned number database is actually rolled out by the FCC, correct?
Yes, or they can use the likelihood scores presented by companies like I know Nexidia used to, Neustar does. They give you a rating, the likelihood rating of whether that number is still associated with Roseanne Anderson. There's something kind of cool, though, I will tell you with, I know this to be true with solutions by text, depending upon the platform you use, and you can all ask your text provider because I want to be more generic, but I do know with solutions by text, once a number is subscribed to solutions, let's say to a texting service with a collection agency, they will tell you, if that number is deactivated or ported, they will absolutely block any further communications by text with that number once it's been, if it's deactivated or ported. So there's some interesting solutions out there in the marketplace, but for all practical purposes, David nailed the risk. If it's transferred from the creditor to the debt collector, you are still going to need to take steps to identify whether that the consent is was provided by the persons currently associated with the mobile number.
And then Roseanne, I know we're just about running out of time here, but in talking about text and when you talked about using abbreviations and different keywords and in your communications with consumers, especially in the context of debt collection, would you also advise that, companies should be very careful about what type of words that they are using, because the words that they use can also be considered in the connection with communication with a particular consumer, and whether those words maybe are misleading, are confusing, or maybe potentially cause a misrepresentation because of the use of the words. So I think those type of things need to also be factored in. Do you agree with that?
Yes, that's an interesting observation.
So just be careful. And when you're rolling out the language that you're going to be using in your text messages to consumers, make sure that you're not using something that will mislead, misrepresent, or potentially even harass the consumer, especially when you're looking at federal and state laws.
If I can interrupt for just a minute, we've got about 5 minutes left. There are some questions that have been asked in the queue. Do you want to continue with some more of the presentation before we get to the questions? Do you want to take some of the questions now? How would you like to proceed? You want to take questions?
I think we should take questions, yep.
All right, excellent. Here's a question. Consumers wishing to email or chat with us must check a box acknowledging acceptance of our terms and conditions before they can actually email or chat. Is adding this email chat authorized to our system notes sufficient when an email chat is received, or must we implement a process whereby we somehow capture their acceptance and the specific terms thereof in our collection system or paperless system?
Well, I'll just say initially that I think it's excellent that you are, before you're either, I think what you're saying is before you're starting a text or an email campaign, you're having someone sign up via your website, and then your website has certain terms and conditions pertaining to all, at least the terms and conditions that you state will apply to your email and your text campaign. Roseanne and I both do compliance. Just a note that those terms and conditions and every single word should be so scrupulously reviewed to make sure that you're not making a potential misrepresentation under various state laws. It may comply with one state, but maybe it violates another state. So you just want to make sure that your terms and conditions are solid, that you are getting capture. And if you're saying that you want to somehow tie that into your compliance management system over on the collection side, that would, I think, alert your agents that you do in fact have that type of consent that was granted. I think the more that you can marry those two together, I think it's absolutely advisable if you can. I hope that answers the question.
The only thing I would add is that I'm not a huge fan of everything being in your screen notes. Yes, you could retrieve them if someone held a proverbial, you know what, to your head. I mean, you could find them, but it's clumsy. And so I would say, if you said, is it an absolute requirement that we have a field that says we captured consent, as you described, to email or chat? No, there's not a law, but it's going to be a question of how are you managing consent and revocation of consent. So the problem with screen notes is that it might have occurred like 3 years ago, and I'm not sure how your agents are able to view it. And I like the field actually on the UI, because then the agent could say, oh, I see you haven't signed up for our email program. You know, feel free to visit our website or whatever you would tell them to do and enroll. Or the person calls and says, quit with the emails already. I'm done with you people. So then you uncheck it. So I that's the only thing I know for myself. I don't like managing consent and revocation of consent for anything only in screen notes. I like fields, auditable fields, and I like it when it's presented to the agent.
Right. Okay. Something that the agents are familiar with, understand, and know how to read simply and quickly, especially when they're on the phone with consumers.
Roseanne, we had a question asked, what are some other subject line examples you recommend using in emails?
Your Chase account, your payment date. You could probably say something but I really like your Chase account, your Walmart account. Something very basic like that. Okay. If it was a receipt, your receipt. I mean, anything that's plain language to a consumer, I would think is fine. But the little message, quippy little message, is what I would avoid.
Got it. A question, would a communication to confirm an email address trigger the e-sign requirements for validation notices?
Wait a minute. Would a communication to confirm
an email address?
No,
No. Trigger B, okay.
No, it wouldn't trigger E sign because there's no, we can't, I can't find, unless you can, the listener can find the law that says you have to confirm emails in a writing and then send something to them in writing. Like, unless there's some law that says you have to do something in writing, you don't have to mess with e-sign consent.
Okay. Another one, a scenario, we have a short code that consumers can text that will send them a link that takes them directly to our payment site for ease of making a payment with less keystrokes. Do you see any concerns? This questioner also added, we send a 1692G written notice on all new accounts.
I mean, David, I don't know if you want to take this one, but I don't see a problem with a person who has obviously subscribed to your short code program. If you said, I can't tell by the question, did they push the payment option to the person or was it a keyword? Like the person called it up like pay or
I'll reread it. We have a short code that consumers can text to that will then send them a link that takes them directly to our payment site.
Yeah. No, you certainly don't need e-sign for that. Second of all, I don't see any problem with that because that's self-service. And, you know, granted, I don't have every fact in front of me regarding your system, but the way it's been described, they can text to it. It's a little bit different than you pushing it to them. And even that wouldn't bother me all that much if you have their consent. But I like what you're doing. I think that makes it easy for the consumer.
Okay. Well, we're over the hour. Do you have do you both have time for one more question, or do we have to go?
It's up to David. Did he go quiet?
Is this silence consent?
I think so.
Okay.
Let's call it consent.
We'll call it consent. One more question.
Let's record it.
another required disclosure is the mini Miranda disclosure. Providing the disclosure in every communication is required, then doesn't that require consent under e-sign? Granted, the disclosure itself is required only if we communicate with the consumer. It is the third side of the same coin. What about written responses to disputes, which are required? When sent by email, is e-sign consent required? What about state-required disclosures like permit number disclosure, et cetera? There's a lot to unpack there.
Out of time. No, I'm kidding. What I would say is this, that those are, actually, I would love to have that question submitted and I would like to write a blog on it and break it out. So let's do that anyway, Mike. But what I would say is this,
absolutely.
If the person sending, if you find a law that says you have to provide blah, blah, blah to the person in writing, you have to mail it, you have to send it in writing, then e-sign would be required if you're going to substitute the digital delivery, text or email in this example, for that snail mail delivery. So we always go back, whatever people ask, I always go, what is the law that tells us we have to do that? Now, the law regarding, like, when we caught, remember all these collection notices that have backers on them, those long backers, David sent me a great list of this morning. They go on, they're paragraphs of things. Those are for collection notices. Those are writings. Those would have to be, if you send an email, all your emails would trigger those state backer requirements. Your text messages are calls. So those kinds of state requirements are not going to find their way into a text message, but don't hang up, because those are state collection, like paper notice backers. And so when you substitute email, because it's a writing, for the paper, which is a writing, then you have to put all those on. Text, though, there are a lot of states, 6 or 7, I'm trying to nail these down too, and I'm gonna write about this because it's coming up so frequently. If the state law says in all communications, you shall say, in all communications, that would mean every text, right? Every single one. This is a communication from a debt collector and all information obtained will be used for that purpose. Well, you probably just hit your 160 character limit and you'd say, thanks, talk to you later. So it renders it almost an ineffective communication. And what David and I talked about before this webinar, what we thought would be the best recommendation in those few states that trigger, that cause you to put very long statements, Illinois is the same, very long statements into a phone call or text or any communication, mm-hmm. just use email. Just use email, comply with, do everything you need to do in email, and maybe text isn't your first, your best choice in those states. I can't help that we don't have better law on it. Lavallee kind of failed us in terms of these link agreements. The proposed rules will be addressing the use of hyperlinks with much more clarity, but until then, the conservative agency may want to use email for those kinds of states that really plague us with long, long disclosures that must be in all communications.
Excellent. Well, we're well past the hour, so let me start wrapping up. Roseanne, David, thank you so much. I really appreciate the length and breadth of information that you provided here today. I know there's a ton more that you didn't get a chance to get to, so maybe we can talk about a follow-up webinar where we get to finish this, because I think this is important, and I think everybody else who's listening today would absolutely agree with me. So thank you very much. For sharing with us today. Also want to thank Ontario Systems for sponsoring today's webinar. Please go to www.ontariosystems.com to learn more about the company. Tried to get to as many questions as we could. If I didn't, I apologize, but thanks to everybody for participating and listening today. A recording of today's webinar will be posted to accountsrecovery.net later today, so you can check out the webinar recordings page to find it. A final reminder for everyone to please fill out the survey and just confirm what we all know to be true, that Roseanne and David all did both did awesome today and deserve 5 out of 5 across the board. Also, if you have any other ideas that you want to share, that's your best opportunity. And I hope everyone stays tuned to accountsrecovery.net for news and more webinars in the very near future. Roseanne, David, thank you both so much. This was great.
Thank you, my friend. And thank you all for listening.
Take care, everybody. Enjoy your day.